The biblical book of Esther was known to some of the significant statesmen in American history who utilized the book in their own writings and rhetoric. On December 17, 1778, George Washington penned a letter from his winter quarters in Middlebrook, New Jersey, to the president of Pennsylvania, Joseph Reed. Washington lamented the rampant war profiteering, declaring, quote, "I would to God that one of the most atrocious of each state was hung in gibbets upon a gallows five times as high as the one prepared by Haman." Thomas Jefferson, after the Revolution, reflected in a letter that, quote, "If our country, when pressed with wrongs at the point of the bayonet, had been governed by its head instead of its heart, where should we have been now, hanging on a gallows as high as Haman's?" And my favorite American quote related to the Megillah, related to the book of Esther, comes from one of my favorite Americans, Abigail Adams, whom I'm lobbying to have replace Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill, wrote about the former governor of Massachusetts, royal governor of Massachusetts, wrote to her own husband, John, quote, "I suppose you will receive two or three volumes of that forlorn wretch Hutchinson's letters." And then she adds, quote, "May the fate of Mordecai be his." The fate of Mordecai? What does this mean? It would appear that Abigail Adams, in her anger, confused the hero and the villain in this eternal tale, as mixed up Haman and Mordecai. But perhaps Abigail was merely embodying obedience to the troubling Talmudic dictum that one is obligated to drink on the holiday of Purim, ad lo yada ben arur haman lebaruch Mordechai, until one has reached a point of inebriation where one has lost the ability to distinguish between cursing Haman and blessing Mordechai. This is precisely what she's doing in this letter. She's just observing Jewish law in a proper fashion. But the most interesting reference to the story of Purim, to the story of Esther, is related to Lincoln. As Aaron Zelensky, who assembled these interesting quotes, notes in an interesting article, on June 12, 1848, Lincoln detailed how the Whig Party's nomination of Zachary Taylor, a war hero, would hurt their rivals, the Democrats. And he wrote, quote, "The war is now to them the gallows of Haman, which they built for us, and on which they are doomed to be hanged themselves." 7 years later, Lincoln wrote to his old friend Joshua Speed about Kansas's constitution, which allowed authorities, quote, "to hang men who shall venture to inform a Negro of his freedom." Lincoln remarked about this law that, quote, "If, like Haman, they should hang upon the gallows of their own building, I shall not be among the mourners for their fate," end quote. So, ladies and gentlemen, Lincoln knew the story of Esther, and he knew it well, and he actually applied it to the moral and political quandaries of his age. And rightly so, for as we shall see, Esther is a book that is more about politics and statecraft than any other book in the Bible. And thus, in today's lecture, I will utilize Esther and its insights as a lens through which to look at the legacy of Abraham Lincoln, a man rightly revered as America's greatest president, but whose greatness is often fundamentally misunderstood. We begin by considering a case in which others made an argument to Lincoln from the Book of Esther. On September 13, 1862, the Reverend W.W. Patton, an American pastor from my hometown of Chicago, Illinois, and a prominent abolitionist, took a contingent of clergymen to the White House and presented the president with a memorandum of an assortment of Protestant ministers from Lincoln's home state of Illinois, with one central message, urging the president to utilize his authority as wartime commander-in-chief in issuing a proclamation freeing all the slaves in the South. The petition read as follows, quote, "We urge you, therefore, as the head of this Christian nation, from considerations of moral principle and as the only means of preserving the Union, to proclaim without delay national emancipation. However void of authority in this respect you might have been in time of peace, you are well aware as a statesman that the exigencies of war are the only limits of its powers, especially in a war to preserve the very life of the nation." Then, in their words to him, these ministers deliver a Dvar Torah, citing the turning point in the book of Esther, where Mordechai galvanizes Esther into action to seek to reverse Haman's decree. The ministers wrote to Lincoln and said to Lincoln as follows. At the time of the national peril of the Jews under Ahasuerus, Mordechai spoke in their name to Queen Esther, who hesitated to take the step necessary to their preservation, in these solemn words, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" And, they continued after quoting Esther, "Your memorialists," meaning the ministers, "believe that in divine providence you have been called to the presidency to speak the word of justice and authority, which shall free the bondmen and save the nation. Our prayer to God is that by such an act the name of Abraham Lincoln may go down in posterity with that of George Washington as the second savior of our country." End quote. In other words, they believe that they are speaking to the president as Mordechai spoke to Esther, and we must appreciate the moral power of the scripture that they are citing. As soon as Mordechai hears of the decree against the Jews, he acts dramatically, defiantly, publicly. In Hebrew, Vayikra Mordechai et begadav, Vayobash sak va'efer, Vayetze betoch ha'ir, Vayitzak tzaka gedola umara. He tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth, walks out on the street, and screams at the top of his lungs a bitter cry. What is happening here is Mordechai is stepping forward publicly as a Jew. Many have noted that the most shocking sentence in the book of Esther is something seemingly innocuous. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan habira u'shmo Mordechai. There was a Jew in Shushan, the capital, whose name was Mordechai. Why is that shocking? Because Mordechai is not a Jewish name. It is a pagan name. Marduk actually is a pagan god. So here we have a story where one of its very heroes has a name that is not a Jewish name, one linked to a Persian pagan deity. Jackie Mason has a routine in which he mocks American Jews for their penchant for Gentile names.
I know one kid is named Crucifix Finkelstein.
Mordechai HaYehudi, Mordechai the Jew, is the equivalent of Crucifix Finkelstein. The very name demands that we ask when we hear it, what is his true identity? And now we know. He's stepping forward and he says, "I am not Mordechai the royal courtier, I am a Jew. I will take this issue to the streets." And when his cousin, the queen, hears this, she is horrified, and she asks him to put back on his Persian courtier's clothing. Mordechai, in response, demands that she do what he is doing, protest, but to do it not in the streets, but right in front of the king, to storm into her throne room and plead for her people. And she says, "I'm not allowed in to see the king without permission. I could be killed for this offense. I haven't seen him for a month." And the response of Mordechai was cited by the ministers to Lincoln. "Do not think that you can be saved in the royal palace, because salvation will arise for the Jews. And if you do nothing, it is you and your father's house who will be lost. And who knows, perhaps it was for this moment that Providence has brought you to your royal position." This is actually an emotional assault on Esther. As Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein once put it, Mordechai, in his response to her, does not attribute her lack of willingness to go to Ahasuerus to weakness. Rather, he accuses her of cowardice, of this being a calculated choice, that she's thinking, "Let the entire nation be destroyed. I'll remain secure in the royal palace." And he's saying to her, if you really cared, if you considered your own soul at stake, would you be able to say, I haven't been to see the king for a month. Is this the response of someone who cares? Mordechai, in other words, is saying to Esther, don't compromise. You have to be prepared for self-sacrifice. Think not about your own personal interests, but about the national interests that will dictate your plans and actions. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. So this, ladies and gentlemen, is the allegory, the parallel that the ministers, these abolitionists, are implicitly establishing here. It is an accusation to the president. When sourced in scripture, they are saying to Lincoln, we are Mordechai. We have been the ones, the abolitionist movement. We've been protesting slavery in the streets. What have you done? You have risen to power in this newly founded Republican Party with an anti-slavery platform. And now the moment has arrived. The slave-holding South has rebelled. You have wartime powers to end slavery, and you have not acted. By citing Mordechai, they are subtly suggesting that his own public anti-slavery position was a posture, that deep down he was apathetic, that he didn't care. This was the message based on Esther. This was the Dvar Torah, delivered to Lincoln by the clergy on September 13th, 1862. It was only several days later, on September 22nd, that Lincoln issued his proclamation that slaves in rebel states would be henceforth forever free. And so it would seem that the minister's message had hit home and the scriptural citation had had its desired effect. But the truth is that the Emancipation Proclamation had already been sitting in Lincoln's drawer for many weeks. Lincoln just didn't issue it because he knew that short of a battlefield victory by the North, it would have had no effect. It was only after the Battle of Antietam, which occurred 4 days after Lincoln's meeting with the ministers, only after the Union achieved some form of military victory, that Lincoln said to his cabinet, quote, I think the time has come now. The action of the army against the rebels has not been quite what I should have best liked, but they have been driven out of Maryland, and Pennsylvania is no longer in danger of invasion. Moreover, the proclamation when issued, ladies and gentlemen, if we think about it, did not actually embrace the full moral ideal of freeing the slaves, because it didn't free the slaves in the border states that had not rebelled. Kentucky, Maryland, and Missouri. Why? Because as Lincoln said, in this war, I dearly want the Lord Almighty on my side, but I must have Kentucky. And so Lincoln knew that only in preserving the Union could slavery ultimately be abolished. Lincoln, no less than these ministers, wanted slavery to die out, but he understood that just boldly embracing a moral ideal would not actually end slavery, that it could only be achieved, to use a Jewish term, which has no good parallel in any other language, with seichel, with wisdom and foresight, which is not a great translation, but the best that we can do, even if it meant not outwardly embracing the full-on abolitionist cause. In other words, Lincoln's greatness lies in his complexities, in his balance of the real and the ideal, and of his willingness, to accept what is less than ideal in order to achieve the real. Or as the historian Eric Foner put it, the hallmark of Lincoln's greatness was his combination of bedrock principles with open-mindedness and capacity for growth. And this is something that is easy to miss. All too often, the legend of Lincoln lies in the extremes. He's either the man who fought the Civil War to free the slaves, or he's the man who mercifully forgave those who rebelled against him, as he said in the second inaugural, with malice toward none. One of my favorite Lincoln-related stories comes from Tolstoy, who wrote the following, I quote in part. Once, while traveling in the Caucasus, I happened to be a guest of a Caucasian chief of the Circassians, who, living far away from civilized life in the mountains, had but a fragmentary and childish comprehension of the world and its history. So, he writes, I was received with the usual Oriental hospitality, and after our meal was asked by my host to tell him something of my life. Yielding to his request, I began to tell him of my profession, of the development of our industries. He listened to everything with indifference, but when I began to tell him about the great statesmen and the generals of the world, he seemed to become very much interested. Wait a moment, he interrupted. I want all my neighbors and my sons to listen to you. I will call them immediately. He soon returned with a score of wild-looking riders and asked me to politely to continue. So, writes Tolstoy, I spoke at first of our czars and their victories. I spoke of the foreign rulers. My talk seemed to impress them deeply. The story of Napoleon was so interesting to them that I had to tell them every detail. When I declared that I had finished my talk, my host, a gray-bearded tall rider, rose, lifted his head, and said very gravely, "But you have not told us a syllable about the greatest general and greatest ruler of the world. We want to know something about him. He was a hero. He spoke with a voice of thunder. He laughed like the sunrise, and his deeds were strong as the rock and as sweet as the fragrance of roses. The angels appeared to his mother and predicted that the son whom she would conceive would become the greatest the stars had ever seen. He was so great that he even forgave the crimes of his greatest enemies and shook brotherly hands with those who had plotted against his life. His name was Lincoln, and the country in which he lived is called America, which is so far away," said this chieftain, "that if a youth should journey to reach it, he would be an old man when he arrived. Tell us of that man. Yes, tell us, please, and we will present you with the best horse of our stock," shouted the others. Writes Tolstoy, "I looked at them and saw their faces all aglow while their eyes were burning. I told them of Lincoln and his wisdom, of his home life and youth. They asked me 10 questions to one which I was able to answer. They wanted to know all about his habits, his influence upon the people, and his physical strength. But they were very astonished to hear that Lincoln made a sorry figure on a horse and that he lived such a simple life. Tell us why he was killed," one of them said. "I had to tell everything. After all my knowledge of Lincoln was exhausted, they seemed to be satisfied. I can hardly forget the great enthusiasm which they expressed and their wild thanks and desire to get a picture of the great American hero. I said that I probably could secure one from my friend in the nearest town, and this seemed to give them the greatest pleasure." This is the legend of Lincoln in far off East Asia. Even Tolstoy himself, who may have understood human beings better than any other in the history of literature, said the following about Lincoln, building on the story he told. "Of all the great national heroes and statesmen of history, Lincoln is the only real giant. Alexander, Frederick the Great, Caesar, Napoleon, Gladstone, and even Washington stand in greatness of character and depth of feeling and in a certain moral power far behind Lincoln. Lincoln," said Tolstoy, "was a man of whom a nation had a right to be proud." Now listen to this. "He was a Christ in miniature, a saint of humanity, whose name will live thousands of years in the legends of future generations. We are still too near his greatness, and so can hardly appreciate his divine power. His genius is still too strong and too powerful for the common understanding, just as the sun is too hot when its light beams directly on us." That's Tolstoy. But of course, to speak this way is to fundamentally misunderstand Lincoln's genius and the essence of a truly successful political leader. Had Lincoln been a saint, he would have been a great American moral figure, but he would not have been a successful president. As my friend, the great Lincoln scholar Harold Holzer, once put it, "For years, historians oversimplified Lincoln as the man who freed the slaves. Then, after the civil rights movement a century later, the pendulum swung to such a sharp degree that some now question Lincoln's sincerities as a progressive freedom fighter. Both extremes," Harold writes, "are ridiculous. It is true," he writes, "that Lincoln was not the most liberal rights advocate in America of his time. Frederick Douglass was more so, of course. But Lincoln was the electable one who exercised his power to destroy slavery. As for equal rights, he was a gradualist, which is why he was able to win national elections in an innately cautious and deeply racist country. We owe it to Lincoln," Harold said, "to judge his achievements and sacrifices by the standards of his century, not ours." And so the lesson of his life is that for great leaders, a sweeping moral vision is necessary, but not sufficient. What is also required is the wisdom and the statecraft to proceed in a way that these goals can actually be attained. And rightly understood, in a different context, that is ultimately the lesson of the Book of Esther. Mordecai galvanized Esther into action, but she does not follow his plan, which was to storm immediately into her husband's throne room and demand that the Jews be speared, and to say, "And by the way, I'm a Jew and I've been lying to you about my identity this whole time." And to say that to the man who's just killed his last wife. That was Mordecai's plan. That was his plan. Okay? And she decides, for some strange reason, not to go with that. Not to take that approach. That would have ended with her certain death. Instead, she laid an elaborate strategy over several days, played on the insecurities of a paranoid king, built up his own jealousy of Haman, and then at the right moment, at her antidote, as it were, she seized the opportunity and her own political play resulted in the death and downfall of the enemy and the salvation of the Jews. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik once put it this way: Mordechai sparked the fire, but it was Esther that executed. As he put it, Mordechai held the view that immediate spontaneous action on the part of Esther is inevitable. Esther should appear before the king, taking the risk of being rejected and executed, and plead with him hysterically to spare her people. Esther, writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, did not concur with Mordechai. Esther, with her incisive intelligence, understood that no plea addressed to the king would produce any results. Hysterical cryings would at best be ineffectual. At worst, they may cause the infliction of more harm. Could anyone sway Stalin from his mad designs? Esther could avail herself of one method only, namely to turn the tables on Haman, to accuse him of plotting against the king and the empire, to arouse doubts in the sick king's mind concerning Haman's loyalty and devotion. And, he continues, Esther succeeded. A young, frail maiden defeated the most powerful prime minister in the annals of Persia. Yes, Mordechai was the initiator, the teacher, the first messenger. He awakened her. He fired her imagination and sensitized her heart. Through him came the inspired word to her. Yet the strategy was hers. The critical decisions how and when to do it were hers. She could not consult Mordechai, and even if she could, she would not have accepted advice from him. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik. And understood this way, the book of Esther contains lessons for leaders today, just as the story of Lincoln does. In Spielberg's extraordinary film about Lincoln, which I heartily recommend to you all, Daniel Day-Lewis, playing Lincoln, said the following. And when I saw it, I was so hoping that Lincoln actually said this. Unfortunately, Lincoln did not say this, but it actually perfectly captures Lincoln's greatness as a leader. In the film, Daniel Day-Lewis, speaking to one of the ardent abolitionists in the Congress, says the following. When I was surveying a compass, it'll point you true north from where you're standing, but it's got no advice about the swamps and deserts and chasms that you'll encounter along the way. If in pursuit of your destination, you plunge ahead, heedless of obstacles, and achieve nothing more than to sink in a swamp, what's the use of knowing true north? That's Lincoln in the film. That's good, right? Fortunately, he didn't say it. But it captures what Lincoln's greatness truly was. Mordechai in the book of Esther is the one who stresses the true north. And once Esther is pointed true north, and she needs to be pointed, but once she's pointed true north, she is the only one who truly surveys the political scene, who knows how to get where she needs to get without falling into the political pitfalls along the way. This, then, is how the book of Esther allows us to appreciate the nature of Lincoln's greatness. But we can conclude our reflection by discovering a deeper dimension in this biblical book, which will allow further insight into Lincoln's life and legacy. In approaching Esther as a story, we must ask a basic, obvious question. Didn't Mordechai understand all that we have just explained? How could he not see that what he was proposing, storming into the throne room and protesting Haman's decree, how could he not see that that was folly? How could he not understand that you don't walk into the private room of an ancient king and just say whatever you want to him right in front of his face? This is not America, right? What did Mordechai think Persia was? Ronald Reagan used to tell a wonderful story. Supposedly he told this to Gorbachev about the difference between America and the Soviet Union.
The story was an American and a Russian arguing about their two countries. And the American said, look, in my country, I can walk into the Oval Office, I can pound the president's desk and say, Mr. President, I don't like the way you're running our country. And the Russian said, I can do that. The American said, you can? He says, yes. I can go into the Kremlin, to the General Secretary's office, pound his desk and say, Mr. General Secretary, I don't like the way President Reagan's running his country.
So, what did Mordechai think? This is America? That Esther could just walk right in and say, I don't like the way Ahasuerus is running this country. That's what he's proposing. How could he propose this? He is not a stupid man. Here I think we could suggest something new. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik has stressed that approaching Esther, we have to realize that it is one of the very few books of the Bible that was written with the waning or even at the end of the age of prophecy. He writes as follows. The Megillah, meaning the book of Esther, contains a story of events that occurred in the twilight hour of Jewish history. It marks the passing of a bright, beautiful summer day full of sun, color, and joy, a day on which God's word was on many tongues and his spirit in many hearts. It ushers in a dark, dreary, autumnal night of silence and fear, a night in the course of which God stopped speaking to his people. At that time, the covenantal community was losing slowly but surely the most precious of all gifts, prophecy. The great covenantal dialogue between man and God that God had commenced with Abraham was about to be terminated, and the prophetic community faced a stark, ruthless reality, a non-prophetic existence. With the transition from a prophetic to a non-prophetic community, he writes, the Jewish historical experience changed completely, end quote. And building on this, I would suggest the following. In the earlier books of the Hebrew Bible, aside from the kings themselves, the central actors on the political stage are prophets. At times they are leaders, Joshua, Samuel, and at times more often they are taking on leaders, Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, Jeremiah. From a political and philosophical perspective, what is the job of the prophet? The prophet knows none of these Lincolnian complexities. They are there to deliver a moral and religious message, come what may. God takes care of the rest. Sometimes he protects them, sometimes he doesn't. If Ahab, the wicked king of Israel, murders and steals an Israelite's land, it may not be politically prudent for Elijah, a subject of this king, to storm into the throne room and tell him what he did was wrong. But that does not stop Elijah, who has no compunctions and does exactly what Mordecai wanted Esther to do. Storm into the throne room and yells, "Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, will you murder and then inherit?" Nathan the prophet is well aware that King David, who is of course not Ahab, but who has sinned grievously, who has just gotten rid of Bathsheba's husband by sending him to the front. Nathan knows that a king could very well get rid of him as well, and yet his job is to show up in David's throne room and pronounce, "Atah ha'ish, you are the man that did this." And most importantly for our discussion, Jeremiah at the end of the first temple period knows that he may well be thrown into the dungeon, as he was, for pronouncing his prophecies to the last kings of Judah, but pronounce them nevertheless, he does. To utilize the dialogue from the Lincoln movie, the job of the prophet is to proclaim true north and to always seek it without compromise and not worry about what political pitfalls lie in front of him. Even if, as with Jeremiah, you literally are thrown into a pit. You literally are sent to the dungeon. And this is, of course, the approach that Mordecai adopts. And when pondering the text of the book, we are able to understand why. The only time that the land of Israel is mentioned in Esther is in Mordechai's biography. Who is Mordechai, we are told? He is son of Kish, Asher Hogla Mirushalayim im Hagola, Asher Hoglata im Yechonya Melech Yehuda, who is part of the original diaspora of the elite that was exiled by Babylonia from Jerusalem. This means that either Mordechai or at least his father experienced the end of the kingdom of Judea, of the first temple, of the age of Jeremiah and Huldah and other prophets. This was the model of political action that his father experienced. This was the model of political action that he had imbibed from his birth. This was the model of leadership that was his patrimony. If his father had been exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, then his father was almost certainly an intimate of these prophets. And in Babylonia, he would have known Ezekiel and Daniel, who also fearlessly proclaimed their prophecies while part of this exiled community in the streets and in the courts of pagan kings. So this was the model that Mordechai knew. But what of Esther? Esther, we're told, was an orphan, Mordechai's first cousin. She had lost her parents as a child. Unlike Mordechai, Esther knew none of the generations of the earlier generations of Judea, of the age when prophets stormed royal courts with the words, "Ko Amar Hashem, thus saith the Lord." And thus, perhaps these respective biographies lend a deeper dimension to their perspectives. Mordechai seeks to act as a prophetic figure. He storms the streets of Shushan and he tells Esther to act as Elijah would have done, to come and say, "Thus saith the Lord, I don't like the way you're running this country." And Esther says this is not the way to deal with this situation. Or as Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik put it, The Torah tells us the story of the prophetic community at the hour of triumph, at the hour of revelation and direct contact with God. But Esther, he writes, faced a new question. How can the Jew triumph over his adversaries and enemies if God has stopped speaking to him, if the cryptic message he receives remains unintelligible and incomprehensible? This is the drama of Esther. The age of prophecy is coming to an end. A new approach to politics to safeguarding the Jewish people needs to be adopted while retaining the faith and the loyalty of the past. Esther in the story still wishes all Israelites to gather together in fasting and in prayer. She still seeks divine salvation. She believes in a God who will save them. But her actions are performed still with intuition and realism, with intrigue, playing on the king's emotions, an approach that acknowledges that prophecy is fading into the past, that new methods are required. Understood this way, the characters in Esther provide the first example in the Bible in which a statesman struggles with the fact that the will of God is mysterious, inscrutable, while still believing that he or she is an instrument in the hands of providence itself, and obligated to grope one's way forward toward true north while charting a course and avoiding political pitfalls along the way. It is so striking, then, that precisely in September 1862, precisely when the ministers met with Lincoln and cited of all books the Book of Esther, Lincoln was himself pondering the inscrutability of divine will while reflecting still the earnest faith that God had placed him in this position to act. Thanks to Lincoln's secretary, John Hay, we know that in September, Lincoln had scribbled some thoughts not meant for publication. Amazing few sentences about providence. Lincoln wrote the following, quote, writing to himself, "The will of God prevails. In great contests, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be and one must be wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time. In the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party. And yet the human instrumentalities working just as they do are of the best adaptation to effect his purpose. I am almost ready to say that this is probably true, that God wills this contest and wills that it shall not end yet. By his mere great power on the minds of the now contestants, he could have either saved or destroyed the Union without a human contest. Yet, writes Lincoln, the contest began, and having begun, he could give the final victory to either side any day, and yet the contest proceeds." These are Lincoln's amazing words. It was the historian Mark Knoll who reflected that Lincoln is clearly a believer in God and providence, yet it's a more mysterious God than his contemporaries worshipped. Lincoln's God, in other words, was not the miraculous one of the Exodus or the prophets, but the inscrutable but still providential one of Esther. Lincoln's own secretary noted that in these words, Lincoln, quote, admits us into the most secret recesses of his soul, perplexed and afflicted beyond the power of human help by the disasters of war, the wrangling of parties, and the inexorable and constraining logic of his own mind. He shut out the world one day and tried to put into form his double sense of responsibility to human duty and divine power. And this was the result. It shows, wrote his secretary, the awful sincerity of a perfectly honest soul trying to bring itself into closer communion with its maker. This is Lincoln at precisely this moment when he is meeting with these ministers, citing the Book of Esther. A man believing that he had been chosen, but still seeking to understand the inscrutable will of a God that was not speaking directly to him, that had shown him no miracles and sent him no prophets. Knowing that he was an instrument of God, but chosen not as a prophet, but as a statesman, holding emancipation at bay until it was realistic, and then seizing the moment as God's messenger. This is Lincoln in 1862, at the moment of the Emancipation Proclamation, a man once known by many as an agnostic who had found God's providence precisely in God's inscrutability. As the writer Dan Gilgoff put it, though Lincoln attended a Christian church, Lincoln's God hewed closer to the Old Testament's ruler of nations. And when Lincoln announced his decision to issue the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet, Lincoln said he was honoring a promise he made to God in exchange for a battlefield win at Antietam. God, said Lincoln, to his cabinet, had decided this question in favor of the slaves. A According to one account, a stunned cabinet member asked the ever-rational Lincoln to repeat himself because he couldn't believe the president was basing it on this. God, in other words, is mysterious, but he also demands that he act. This is what Lincoln understood. The ministers were not wrong in citing Esther. Mi yodea im la'et kazot higat lamalchut. Who knows, perhaps for this very reason, God has placed you in power. Thus, the Emancipation Proclamation was issued in September, and as it stated in its own words, it was designated to go legally into effect on January 1st, 1863, in advance of the new year. Frederick Douglass, on this day, with an assembly of abolitionists, gathered at the Fremont Temple in Boston, Massachusetts. The occasion, he remembered, was one of both hope and fear, because they were all worried that Lincoln might renege on this. Whether we should survive or perish depended in large measures upon the coming of this proclamation. We were waiting and listening as for a bolt from the sky, which should rend the fetters of 4 million slaves. We were longing for the answer to the agonizing prayers of centuries. So wrote Douglass. And, ladies and gentlemen, because I always have to find a Jew present at every important moment in history, I'm delighted to inform you that the news of the emancipation, that it was going into effect, was sent all over the country by a Jewish telegrapher working the telegraph for the White House, a man by the name of Edward Rosewater, who, by the way, had worked as a telegrapher for news organizations and had witnessed and reported on the original inauguration of Jefferson Davis in Alabama, and now was working for the White House, sending out news of the Emancipation Proclamation. Jews are everywhere, ladies and gentlemen. Okay? The words Rosewater sent across the country was received in Fremont Temple, and the crowd exploded in jubilation. Wrote Douglass, soon that church was packed from doors to pulpit, and this meeting did not break up till near the dawn of day. It was one of the most thrilling occasions I ever witnessed, and a worthy celebration of the first step on the part of the nation in its departure from the thraldom of ages. It is indeed an incredible moment in American history, and an answer to the prayers of the abolitionists, who, several months before, had presented Lincoln with a petition and a Dvar Torah based on the Book of Esther. And an understanding of this biblical story allows us to better appreciate Lincoln's own uniqueness. It was General Sherman who said of Lincoln that of all the men I have ever met, he seemed to possess more of the elements of greatness combined with goodness than any other. This is perfectly put. Lincoln's refusal to lose sight of true north, to engage in struggling, seeking faith, combined with his hard-headed, calculating statesmanship and his brutal war waging, together provide us with one of the few examples in human history of goodness and greatness enhancing each other. It is this one month of 1862, over a year before the Gettysburg Address, and several years before the second inaugural, where we first find this truly manifest. Herein, we discover why, in America, there was no one like Lincoln, and why we will very probably never see his like again. Thank you very much.